Good evening, Rabbi Schwartz.
Hey, good evening, Chevra. As you remember, we last week began the second perek of Sukkah, and the first Mishnah tells us that if someone is sleeping underneath a bed in the Sukkah, the person does not fulfill the obligation of being in the Sukkah. As we noted last week, there's a machlokas between Rashi and the Rif exactly why. Rashi gives the more simple explanation that if you sleep under a bed in the sukkah, so effectively there's like an ohel, there's a tent on top of you, and that tent is mafsik between you and the sukkah. And that's why you don't get the mitzvah of being in the sukkah, because you have this bed, which is a ohel, it's a tent, and that is blocking you from being inside the sukkah. That's the halacha that we understood last time. However, in the Mishnah,
Is that a bed that has like a top on top of where you're sleeping?
Joseph sent me some pictures of what beds looked like, etc. I think the assumption is that there was something on top of you. It could be that there was no mattress at that time. I think that's what Joseph was sending me. There was no mattress, but nonetheless, there still was. It could be it was just like a flat board, or there was something on top of you that would mean that you're not directly underneath the schach, that there is something between you and the schach. That's what the Mishnah says. Rabbi Yehuda. In the Mishnah comes, Rabbi Yehuda says that our practice was Nohagin Hayinu, Shayinu Yeshenim Tachas Hamita Bifnei Hazakenim, V'lo Amru Lanar, V'lo Amru Lanu Davar. Right? That we slept underneath the bed and there were some Zakenim there. No one said anything. All was grand. So tonight's conversation is going to be about this position of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda's position that you could sleep under a bed in the sukkah. Now, in order to get to the Gemara's explanation, we're going to have a long conversation about, according to Rabbi Yehuda, what exactly constitutes an ohel and halacha. What exactly is considered a tent? That's the long conversation that we'll have. And just remember that this entire conversation is a setup to get us back to the halacha that we saw in the Mishnah, that sleeping under the bed in the sukkah, according to Rabbi Yehuda, is good. Right? So this is all a setup to return us to the line in the Mishnah. So we're going to go a little bit far afield, but don't worry, we will return. So let's pick up from Tanan, right? It's the second line in the Gemara, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines in the bottom. Tanan Hasam, right? We learned a Mishnah in Ahalos. Echad chur shecharruhu mayim o sharatim o sheachloso maleches. Let's say you have a hole that was dug by water. You know, sometimes water can rush and it can make a hole in some rocks. Or you have sharatim, you have some sort of, I don't want to use the word insect, it sounds too small, but maybe an insect. In other words, like termites and the like, they make holes. Oh, achloso maleches, or some salt ate through the substance, v'chein midbach avonim, or if you have an overhang of stones, v'chein so'ar shokoros, or if you have some beams that are just on the ground and they end up, there's some holes between the beams, and therefore, according to halacha, you end up with some sort of tent in all these cases. So what I have in all these cases is I have a halachic tent, an overhang, right? Ohel. I shouldn't use the word tent. I have an ohel. The ohel is formed, though, by some natural occurrence. It's not formed with any conscious intention of making the overhang. Right, that's the case. You have a chorsha harumayim, the water does it, or the termites do it, or the salt does it, or you just have some stones that are hanging out, right? So all these things are mahil al hatuma. In all these cases, the Gemara says that according to the Tanakhama, the first opinion, the Mishnah Halos, is that this is mahil al hatuma. This creates a halachic ohel for purposes of tuma. Remember, for purposes of tuma, if I am under the same overhang as a corpse, so I become tummy. So according to the first opinion here in the Mishnah, I am tummy because I am under an overhang with a corpse. Right? All grand. However, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, right? Rabbi Yehuda says, Ko ohel she'eino asui bidei adam, eino ohel. Rabbi Yehuda says that to be a halachic ohel, it has to be that it was fashioned by a person. Any ohel, ko ohel she'eino asui bidei adam, that was not made by a person, eino ohel. That's not called an ohel. The Gemara continues, my time at Rabbi Yehuda. What's the reason for Rabbi Yehuda? So let's just turn the page. My time with Rabbi Yehuda, what's the reason for Rabbi Yehuda? So the Gemara says, no, wrong page. Sorry. My time with Rabbi Yehuda, no, I think I have it. Right. What's the reason for Rabbi Yehuda? So the Gemara says, Yalef ohel ohel mi mishkan. Rabbi Yehuda says that in order to be considered a tent, it has to be something, thank you, in order to be a tent, it has to be something that is made by a person. It has to be asui bidei adam. How does Rabbi Yehuda know that? He learns a gezeirah shava, Yalef ohel ohel mi mishkan. He learns a gezeirah shava from the Mishkan. Ksiv hacha, zos toras, zos hatorah adam ki yamos ba'ohel. Right? The Torah in Parshas Chukas, when it discusses Tumas Meis, it says that this is the Torah, adam ki yamos ba'ohel. When a person dies in an ohel. Uksiv hasam, and it says by the construction of the Mishkan, vayifros es ha'ohel al ha'mishkan, that Moshe Rabbeinu put the tent on top of the Mishkan. Again, the Mishkan technically are the karashim, are the beams, right? They're that go into the adonim, they go into the sockets, etc. And you have the poles that connect them. That's the technical Mishkan. And there is an ohel that goes on top of it, right? There were the skins of the Oros Elim Adamim, Oros Tichashim, skins of these various animals that went on top of the Mishkan. Moshe Rabbeinu Vayifros Es HaOhel Al HaMishkan. Moshe takes the tent and he puts it on the Mishkan. Moshe puts the tent on top of the Mishkan, on top of this structure of beams that is supporting it. Malahalon Bidei Adam, Afkan Bidei Adam. So the Tanna Rabbi Yehuda says, just like when Moshe Rabbeinu made the Mishkan, he is a person, right? And the word Ohel appears over there. So just like the Ohel that Moshe made was done bidei Adam, so also anything, Rabbi Yehuda says, anything that halachically is considered an Ohel has to be asui bidei Adam. It has to be made by a person. If it's made bidei Shamayim, if it's just something that happened on its own, like the case that we had, that the water creates some sort of overhang or whatever, salt creates overhang, that's not good according to Rabbi Yehuda. That's not halachically considered an overhang. Because to be an overhang, it has to be asui bidei adam. It has to be something that is made by a person. That's what Rabbi Yehuda says. V'rabbanan. But the Chachamim disagree with Rabbi Yehuda. The Chachamim say, Ohel, Ohel, Riba. Right? The Chachamim say that we have the word Ohel many times in that Pasuk. That pasuk in Parshas Chukah says, "Zos haTorah Adam ki yamus ba'ohel kol ha'ba'el ohel v'chol asher ba'ohel yitma shivas yamim." It says "ohel" 3 times in the pasuk, and therefore, because it says "ohel, ohel, ohel" so many times, that tells me that even if it's not made b'day Adam, it still is considered a ohel al pi halacha. That's what the Gemara says. Now let's just pause for a second. So the Tanna Rabbi Yehuda. Again, obviously, this will come back to our Mishnah because Rabbi Yehuda says that they used to sleep under the bed in the sukkah. But the Tanna Rabbi Yehuda says in the Mishnah in Ahalos that in order to be considered a halachic tent, it has to be asui bidei adam, just like the Mishkan was made by a person. This also has to be made by a person. I saw in Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's Sefer, he asked an interesting question, which is that Rashi al-HaTorah writes that Moshe Rabbeinu is looking at the Mishkan, and God is like, okay, Moses, put it up. And Moses is like, God, I can't do it. I have no idea. Like, it's too complicated. Like, there are beams and sockets, and I don't know what to do. So God tells Moshe, you know what, Moshe? Start, make believe, do a little bit, and I'll do it for you. It's a Rashi in Parashas Pekudei, I think. Right, the Torah writes Hukam HaMishkan. Rashi comments Hukam HaMishkan means the Mishkan went up on its own. Meaning, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't really assemble the Mishkan. Hashem did it. Moshe kind of did the act. But that's what Rashi writes al HaTorah. So Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is bothered by the kasha. It's not much of a kasha. Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is bothered. He says, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, Reb Yehuda is saying that to be an ohel, it has to be something that's man-made. Right? And he learns that because Moshe made the Mishkan. But dude, Moshe didn't make the Mishkan. Hashem made the Mishkan. That's his kasha. So he says, yeah, but you know, right, really, Moshe's kind of acting out. It appears that Moshe made it. So that's good enough for the Tana. Of Rabbi Yehuda. Alternatively, Reb Shlomo Zalman says, if you read the Rashi over there in Parashas Pekudei carefully, Rashi is saying that Moshe had difficulty putting up the beams. But once the beams were up, so to place the hides on top of those beams, that was not so difficult, and that Moshe certainly did himself. And the halacha is that that's what's called the ohel, the hides that were placed on top of the beams. That's his argument. Okay.
You could also argue that even if Moshe Rabbeinu didn't do it, you know, put it up himself, it was man-made in that Bezalel and Aliyav created the various items of the Mishkan through their skills.
So I think that's true. The only thing is, you know, Bezalel and Aholiyah, they created the kelim in the Mishkan, obviously. Mm-hmm. Right? But Rabbi Yehuda is saying is that the tent itself, the structure itself, to be a tent, al pi halach, it has to be man-made. Did Bezalel and Aholiyah make the tent? Right? It sounds like, right, by Yefroses Ohel al HaMishkan, is that Moshe did it. Rabbi Yehuda seems to be learning from an action that Moshe Rabbeinu did. Okay. So, be it as it may, right, Yosef's suggestion, I think, was very good, but the Gemara is learning from, what's it called? We're learning from Moshe Rabbeinu, who is putting up the Mishkan. So again, so the Tanna Rabbi Yehuda says that in order to be a tent halachically, it has to be man-made. However, the Tanna Kamma says it doesn't have to be man-made, and the Tanna Kamma learns, ohel, ohel, riba, right? That's what we explained, that there are many psukim. Zos ha-Torah, adam ki yamus ba-ohel, kol ha-bala, ohel, chashe ba-ohel. It says ohel like 3 times in the pasuk. That tells me that any sort of tent can be halachically a tent, even if it's not man-made. So then the Gemara asks a question. The Sava Rabbi Yehuda, I scrolled up, so it's like that, the top of the page. The Sava Rabbi Yehuda, ko ohel she'eno asui bidei adam, eno ohel? Does Rabbi Yehuda really hold that a tent that is not man-made is not halachically considered a tent? Or Rami Nahu, I have the following question. The Parah Aduma. The Parah Aduma had a big machlokas between the Tzedukim and the Perushim about how you make a Parah Aduma. There is a halacha that if you're tamei, you can't be involved in the making of a Parah Aduma. Any stage in the Parah Aduma process is a lot of parts of the Parah Aduma process, right? You have to take the water, you have to burn it, you have to add the ashes to the water, etc. Any stage in the Parah Aduma process, you can't do if you're tamei. That's premise one. Premise two. Ordinarily, a person goes to the mikveh during the day, but the tumah does not leave until night, until dark. Right? That's called Harav Shemesh. That's like the first Mishnah in Brachos. Basically says, Meimosai Koranas Shema Ba'arin, Mishasha Kohan Nechnasim Lecho B'Trumasan. Meaning when it gets dark, the kohanim who are tamei would go to the mikveh during the day, but they're not going to eat the truma until it gets dark because you need something called harav shemesh. Right? That's the ordinary din. Parah aduma, the tzedukim said, you could not make parah aduma until you become fully tahar, which means you have harav shemesh. Which means that you went to the mikvah and it became dark already. That's the tzaddiki opinion. Pharisaic Judaism, the Perushim, the sectarians, I think the literal translation of Perushim would be like sectarians, no? So the Perushim assume that you can be involved in the Parah Aduma process once you went to the mikveh, even before Harav Shemesh, even before it gets dark. Not only did the Perushim assume that you can do this, but in order to make a point that the Tzedukim are incorrect, the Perushim used to go out of their way that a Kohen who'd be involved in the Parah Aduma process, they'd make the Kohen Tameh, and the Kohen would go to the mikveh, and before dark, the Kohen would be involved in the Parah Aduma process to show that those sorduses are just wrong. Right? The Tzedukim, the sorduses assume you have to wait until nighttime. To prove the Tzedukim are wrong, we are not going to take a Tahar Kohen. In order to be involved in the Parah Aduma process, we're going to take a Kohen. We will make the Kohen Tamei. Right, you'll like take a sheret, right? You'll take like a dead bug. In the heights, there are no shortage of sheretim. The cholad, the achbar, etc. You take a dead achbar. It's one of the shmeina sheretim amurim b'torah. Right, we are not going to translate for those of us among, who live in the heights. But you take a sheret, you'll be metameh. The kohen is going to make it. The kohen will go to the mikveh. It's not going to be dark yet, and the kohen is going to be involved in the process. And all of this is done to show that the tzedukim are wrong. Now, this is a tremendous kula. Right? This is really a massive leniency in halacha, that we are specifically doing the Parah Aduma process with someone who has not yet had Harav Shemesh. We have a good reason for this kula. The reason is to, boom, right, to punch those tzedukim in the nose. We want to show them that they're wrong. But ultimately, this ends up being a tremendous kula. Now, the halacha is worried. The way I'm explaining this now is actually what Rashi comments over here. Maybe we'll read the Rashi in a few moments. But the halacha is worried that we can't go too far with kulas. The halacha is worried that since we have a kula that we allow the Parah Aduma process to be done with a kohen who has not yet had Harav Shemesh, so we're worried that people might have too many kulas. So in order to balance it out, they have massive amounts of chumras to balance the kula. And the chumras to balance the kulas are as follows. Urami nahu. We're going to ask in kasha. Chatzeros hayu benuyos birushalayim al gabe hasela. They built courtyards in Yerushalayim on top of rock. V'tachtehen chalal mipnei kever hatahom. And underneath these rocks, there is empty space. And they did this because they are worried about kever hatahom. They're worried about a grave that is very, very far down in the ground. In order to ensure that the grave is not beneath this area, they are trying to create a situation there's absolutely no tumma involved. We'll discuss it in a minute. So they would build courtyards on top of bedrock so that you know there's no graves underneath. And pregnant women would go to these special courtyards. Like, this is the maternity ward in Second Temple times. The maternity ward is that a woman is about to have a baby. She would go to a courtyard that is built on top of bedrock, so you know that there is no grave underneath it. The pregnant women go and they have babies over there. And in that area, they raise their children so that the children will be completely tahar for para aduma purposes. They bring oxen, the algabehen de lassos, and they put doors. By a door, we mean just like a plain board. They put the plain board on top of the oxes. Vitinokos yoshvin algabehen, and the little kids sit on top of these boards, on top of the oxes. Vikosos shall even be a dehem, and they have stone cups. All of this is to avoid tumah. No, the bait. It's like you ask someone, "Where were you born?" In a hospital. I wasn't born in a hospital. I was born on bedrock, right? Because you want the baby to be born in a place where there's zero tumah, and to make sure there's zero tumah, the baby is born there. The baby is raised there. When they're in the process of making the para aduma, they bring the kids, right? Little kids. Who had spent their entire life on top of a rock. They bring these kids to the area where they'll fill up the water, and they bring them on top of oxen, and there are wooden boards on top of the oxen. This is all to prevent tumah somehow. Right? The kosel shel even, they use stone cups. Stone is not makabel tumah. Higiyu l'shiloach, they get to the Meha Shiloach, that is the water outside of Yerushalayim. There's an Arab village right outside of Yerushalayim called Silwan. Mm-hmm. Silwan is the Shiloach. They get to the Shiloach, Yardu L'toch HaMayim, they go into the water, they fill up their stone cups, V'alu, V'yashulohen. Then they come up and they would sit back on their oxen. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Rabbi Yossi says that mimekom ohayim mishalshel, they wouldn't take the kids and lower them into the shiloach to fill up the water, but rather the kids would be sitting on top of the ox and they would lower a cup to fill up the water from the shiloach. Mimekom ohayim mishalshel umimale, and fill it up. All of this concern is because there might be a grave underneath. Vitanya. And the Brisa says, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, lo hayim mevim de lassos, ela shavarim. Right? Rabbi Yehuda says that there is no need to have the doors, to have the flat piece of wood on top of the oxen. Right? All they had was that the kids would sit on the ox. They did not bring the doors. Right? Vitanya, if I'll just scroll up. Right, we learned the Brisa. Rabbi Yehuda says that lo hayim mevim de lassos ela shavarim. They wouldn't bring actual doors; they'd bring oxen. Right, in other words, that they wouldn't have the doors; they would just sit on the oxen. So now the Gemara's question is, v'hashavarim da'ol she'eino asui bidei adam hu. Uktani Rabbi Yehuda omer lo yimavim d'lasos ha'shavarim. Right, this is a setup in the Gemara. We'll come back to it in a minute. But basically, the Gemara asks, Rabbi Yehuda, who we had a few minutes ago, told us that in order to be a tent halachically, it has to be man-made. You're not an ohel, you're not a tent if it's not man-made. Yet I see over here that Rabbi Yehuda says that the kids would sit on top of the ox. The ox is not man-made, right? Oxen are not man-made. And it still is an ohel, it still is a tent that will prevent the tumah that might be underneath the ox from getting to the kid. So that's the Gemara's question, and we'll come back to this question in a few minutes. But let's just take this apart a little bit. Like, this is a very strange halacha. We want to make sure that there is zero tumah involved in the para aduma process. So in order to make sure there's zero tumah involved, right, we have these bedrock areas. We know for sure that there is no grave underneath it. That's where the women have their babies. That's where the kids are raised. When we go to fill up the para aduma water, so they go in this special way that they can't become tameh. There's a question as to whether we take the kid off the ox, put him into the water to fill it up, or whether they just fill it up with a string or the like. Now, this is all in the Gemara. Beautiful. Rashi explains, right? If you look at the Rashi, umeviyin nashin ubros, right? And I scrolled it. It's like the top of this page. Rashi says that since the Mishnah tells us in Para that they would be mitame the Kohen, mitame hayos a Kohen, and then they would put him in the mikvah in order to prove the tzedukim are wrong. So therefore, because they have this one kula, asuba mailos harbe kideshol yizauzluba, so therefore they have many chumris midrabonon, so that people will not be too lenient with the para aduma. And these mailos are, they made takanos that the entire para aduma process should happen with kalim that cannot be makabal tuma, with stone kalim, etc., like we said. In Rav Shechter's Sefer on Chumash, in Parshas Chukas, he uses this idea to kind of create a halachic sense of balance. Rav Shechter quotes, I believe, from Rav Soloveitchik, that in any area of halacha where I have massive kulas, you have to have a big chumrah thrown in to balance the scales. If you have kulas without chumrah, it's not going to be balanced. So sometimes, precisely because I have a kula, and the kula is there for a good reason. I have a kula l'holtzi miliban shel tzedukim, to show that the sword you see is wrong. But because ultimately I'm being super duper makel, so therefore we have to throw in tremendous chumras in terms of the stone, make sure there's no graves underneath, right? All the stuff that we just saw. Rav Shechter explains that this can explain halachos with respect to aguna. Now, when I talk about aguna now, I'm not talking about the modern aguna. The modern aguna that's spoken about is a woman whose husband doesn't want to give her a get. The marriage is functionally over, but doesn't want to give a get. That's what we call an aguna in the modern sense. But in classical rabbinic literature, an aguna is a woman whose husband is presumed dead,
right?
But we don't know for sure that the husband is dead, right? We had this unfortunate, actually the year I was learning these halachos was 9/11. It was 20 years ago. I remember Rabbi Willig said he couldn't believe he'd ever deal with these shilohs, and he did. And Baruch Hashem, the kola was learning the halachos that year. On many mornings, there would be a bezdin in front of the Beis Medrash with Rabbi Willig and Rabbi Shechter and usually Rabbi Yonah Reis, and they would collect testimony to find out that the husband is actually dead, right? They're, all of this is written up. You know, if someone has like a monthly Metro card and you could see the time that the person swiped the card, right, by the World Trade Center station. And it's like, well, I think the first tower was at 9:03 a.m. or something. So if it's like at 8:50, so you could assume he's already in his office by the time the plane hit, etc. These are the types of things that we were dealing with. That's classical aguna. The husband is presumed dead, but we have to ascertain it halachically. And we have certain big kulas in terms of proving that the husband is dead. Halachically, ordinarily, women are not ksheros for edus, no? Usually to edim have to be men, not women. By iguna, mishum iguna akilu barabonim. Right? There are big kulas that we relax the level of testimony that's necessary. That even ed mipi ed, mipi isha, right? We allow things which ordinarily would not be acceptable. We allow them to work because since it's an aguna situation, the rabbis have super duper kulas that they throw in. But because there are so many kulas in the aguna situation, we have to, the Chachomim instituted a massive chumrah to balance the scales. And that chumrah is called Mayim She'en Lahem Sof. Mayim She'en Lahem Sof is as follows. Let's say you have a very large lake and you can't see from one side of it to the other side. It's a large sea, a large lake. You can't see from one side to the other side. Too large. So in that case, if a boat capsizes, so the halacha says by Mayim She'en Lahem Sof, we can't testify that the boat capsized. We haven't seen the guy in a while. We can't say, oh, he's definitely dead, because we're worried maybe he ended up emerging on the other side of the water where we couldn't see. Maybe he ran away and he's over there and maybe he's safe and alive. That's Mayim She'en Lahem Sof. Mayim She'en Lahem Sof is a tremendous chumrah that was thrown into the process. It's a chumrah that doesn't ordinarily make sense according to the strict rules of halacha. According to the strict rules of halacha, like the boat goes down in the middle of the ocean, what do you think happened? There's like a very strong rove. The guy is dead. The halacha follows rove. But we throw this chumrah of Mayim She'en Lahem Sof into the equation to balance all the kulas that we have of Mishum Iguna Kilo Barabonon. The kulas that we have in terms of the type of testimony that we accept mandate that we have another chumrah that's thrown into the miskeret, Rav Schechter says, to balance the scales. That's the way he explains it. But that's the din of Mayim She'en Lahem Sof. And the proof that we need a chumrah sometimes to balance excessive kula is exactly what we see from this Parah Aduma case, no? We have an excessive kula. The excessive kula is that we take the kayin who's going to make the Parah Aduma, and we make the kayin tamei, and we put him in the mikvah, and we have him do the Parah Aduma process before it gets dark. That's an excessive kula. Because of that excessive kula, we throw some excessive chumras in to balance the scales. And that's why everything is done in a way that we know for sure there's no graves underneath, and we use only stone kalem, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? All of that is to balance the chumra kula scale. That's the idea that Rav Schechter develops, which I think is actually a nice, elegant thing. Obviously, it's not an exact equation, but it can help us explain why we have this din of Mayim She'en Lahem Sof, which really does not seem to make any sense. Good?
So for our times, we're living in now, COVID times, and they've made some kulas for halacha.
Yes, sir.
So do you have to balance it out with chumrah?
So here's the thing. I don't think so. In other words, I think there's a difference. You're asking an interesting question. You know, we've had a number of kulas that we came up with because of COVID in terms of truncating davening or whatever it is. But if something is done on an ad hoc basis, on a one-time basis, it's an emergency situation. So, okay, it's an emergency. We understand you have kulas. And the expectation is that we'll go back as soon as possible. We're going to go back to the way things were beforehand. Okay. These halachos are permanent laws. The permanent law of Parah Aduma has a certain kula. So therefore, the permanent law of Parah Aduma requires certain chumras. The permanent law of Aguna has certain kulas. So the permanent law of Aguna requires chumras. That's the basic point. Pardon me. So let's just return to what we were up to. The Rabbi Yehuda told us that to be an ohel, it has to be man-made. The Gemara has a question that according to Rabbi Yehuda, the children who are born, who are going to be involved in making Parah Aduma stuff, and have to be completely tahar, the children ride on oxen. And the ox is an ohel. The ox is like a halachic tent that the tumah doesn't get through. All is grand. So the Gemara asks, one second, but this is an ohel that's not asui bidei adam. It's not made by people. So how could it be an ohel according to Rabbi Yehuda? Right, that's the Gemara's question. The Gemara asks, "V'hashavarim." You see, I scrolled. Right, V'hashavarim is at the top of the page. You could see, "V'shavarim the ohel she'eno asui bidei adamhu." Uktayim Rabbi Huda Omer lo hayim mevim d'lasos ella shavarim. But oxen are a tent. An ox is not man-made. So how did it work according to Rabbi Yehuda? So the Gemara says, "Ki aser Rav Dimi, Amr Rav Lazar, Rav Dimi." Came to Bavel, he reported in the name of Rebbe Lazar that Moda Rebbe Yehuda Kimlo Egrof. Meaning, even though Rebbe Yehuda says that a tent which is not man-made is not halachically considered an ohel has to be man-made, that's Rebbe Yehuda's Shita, but that is an ordinary sized ohel. If you have an ohel that is kimlo egrof, it's like the size of a fist. It's a larger ohel. So in that case, Rabbi Yehuda agrees that even though it is not a asui bidei adam, even though it's not made by a person, still it's a good ohel. So since the ox is mlo egrof, the ox is large, it is the size of a fist, but still, it's going to be, even though Rabbi Yehuda says that an ohel that is not made bidei adam is not an ohel, but since this case is kimlo egrof, so it's going to be an ohel. That's what the Gemara says. Mod Rabbi Yehuda, Kimlo Egrof. Rabbi Yehuda agrees if it's a large thing, it's the size of an egrof. Tanyanami Hachi, the Gemara says, right? I have a price like that. Umod Rabbi Yehuda, b'shakifin, b'nekike hasala'im. Rabbi Yehuda agrees, by shakikim and nekike hasala'im, these are like big rock formations. Even though these are things that are bidei shamayim, it's made by Hashem, still Rabbi Yehuda agrees, because it's a large thing. And by large things, that's enough to be considered a ohel. Even though it's not bidei adam, even though it's not made by a man. Now, the Gemara then says, one second. Vahare delas. Diyesh ba kama egrofin. Uktani Rabbi Yehuda Omer. The Gemara asks, well, one second. How come Rabbi Yehuda says they did not use the doors on top of the oxen, right? That they would just have the oxen? I don't understand. The door itself is quite wide. If it's wide, it would count as an ohel. no matter what. So why does Rabbi Yehuda say that they did not use the doors? So Amar Abaye, lo hutzrichu lo havid losos. Abaye says that they really could have brought doors, but what Rabbi Yehuda is saying is lo hutzrichu lo havid losos. They didn't have to bring doors. Rava Amar, lo hayim ivin de losos ko ikar, shemipne shadaito shaltino gagasa olam, Shema Yelti Rosho O Echame Yivarav V'Yitame Bekever. Right, Rava says that they would not bring doors at all, because if you bring a door and the door is like a wide thing, the concern is that the kid is going to get all excited. It's like a big wide thing. He'll be very comfortable and he'll like lean over, and he might end up leaning over the Kever Hatahom. He'll lean over the grave underneath it. Oh, maybe the continuation of the Gemara, I didn't remember how much is on Amid Beis, but maybe the continuation of the Gemara is not so important. Let's go back to this Gemara. Yeah, oh, it will all come back to our Mishnah about sleeping under a bed in the Sukkah. It will come back to that, but we're not there yet. So let's just analyze what we have so far. What we've learned so far is that according to Rabbi Yehuda, to be an ohel, it has to be made by a human. It has to be man-made. Just like Moshe Rabbeinu put up the Mishkan, an ohel has to be man-made. However, Rabbi Yehuda allows something that's bidei shamayim to count as an ohel if it is quite large. If it is wide enough that it's kimlo egrof, then it is able to count as an ohel, although it is not made bidei adam. That's what the Gemara says. Now, let's just talk about this in the context of as follows. Let's see this Tosis over here about Al-Gabehen Delossos. We'll read the Gemara. I'm not sure if we'll get to the Gemara next week, or maybe we'll get there still tonight, how the Gemara ties this back to our Mishnah. But if you remember, the issue is that we want to make sure that these little kids are perfectly pure. The way I make sure they're perfectly pure is they're born on a rock, they're raised on a rock, right? And we take them to Parah Aduma on top of animals, on top of doors, on top of animals. These kids are perfectly pure. Gevaldik, amazing. The idea is that we want the kid to be on top of an ohel, so any tumah underneath does not penetrate that ohel, and the kid is going to be tahar. The kid is on top of the ox. The ox is wide enough, halachically it's an ohel. The kid is on top of a board. The board is halachically wide enough, it's an ohel. Therefore, you don't become tameh. Tosis asks Akasha. Tosis, dear Masuva Agabeyan Dlosis. Tosis asks Akasha. There's a machlokas in Meseches Gittin, and in Nozir, and in Erevin, and in Chagiga, about Ohel Zaruk. Okay, let's go slowly. An Ohel is a tent. If there's a corpse underneath a tent, and I'm on top of the tent, so the tumah spreads throughout the tent, but the individual on top of the tent is going to be tahar, because the tent blocks the tumah from going through. But Tosis asks Akasha. There's a Gemara in many places in Shas that says the ohel zaruk lo shmei ohel. A flying ohel or a moving ohel is not considered an ohel lachut b'fnei hatuma, to be a barrier for tuma. So Tosis has a kasha. I don't understand. I don't understand, Tosis asks. The kid is on top of the ox. Is the ox moving? Oh yeah, sure it is, right? That's what, right? It's not a dead ox. We don't take the kid and put on top of a dead ox. It doesn't move. Right? Then the kid will become tummy from the dead ox. We want the kid to be tahar, right? So the ox is moving. If it's moving, it's an ohel zaruk. It's a moving ohel. a moving ohel is not halachically an ohel. So Tosis is bothered by the kasha. What does it help? Right? We want the kid to remain tahar. So you put the kid on a board on top of an ox, whatever we're doing. But Tosis asks, what's an ohel zarek? It's a movable tent. And the movable tent is halachically not a tent to prevent tumah from penetrating. So Tosis answers, Matzi lemeimar, the savar l'karabi Yehuda, the amar b'shmeitin lo hayim mevi'in delasus ela shavarim shekresol sehen rechavos, v'af alpi shegam hem ohel zaruk, mikol mokom b'detu goli rachmoni chashivi ohel, k'dedashina midiksev u'batzamos u'begidim t'solchicheni. Tosis basically says that later on in the Gemara, there will be a gezeres hakosov. There's going to be a special pasuk that teaches us that the ox is considered an ohel. The Gemara will use a special pasuk that the ox is an ohel, that with the bones and the sinews you make schach for me. Schach is the same as an ohel. So you see from that pasuk that the animal is considered an ohel. Okay. Therefore, Zaktaisus, even though ordinarily ohel zaruk is not ohel, but since in this case it's a gezeres hakosuk that ohel, that it is an ohel, there's a pasuk that tells me that the ox is an ohel, so that is good enough. Let's just pause for a minute. This is already interesting. This halacha of ohel zaruk, not being an ohel, is an interesting halacha. First of all, there are Rishonim who say that the halacha of ohel zaruk is only in the case of a flying bird. The Mishnah in Ohalos writes that of ha'ofef, if you have a flying bird or you have like a piece of fabric that's flying through the air, that's not called an ohel. There are some who understand that if it is on the ground and it's just being dragged along, that would be considered an ohel. There's some lengthy literature about this, that it could be that it is considered an ohel when it is on the ground. I see from this Tosis that that's not correct. The fact that Tosis is invoking the principle of ohel zaruk, the principle of flying ohels, even though the ox is presumably going on the ground, walking, the ox is not flying through the air, no? If the ox is flying through the air, we are afka haktat saris. The ox is not flying through the air. It's on the ground. I still apply the principle of ohel zaruk to something that is on the ground. This is relevant for a few things. There's a famous tshuva of the Noda b'Yehuda. Noda b'Yehuda in Chelek Madura Tinyana Chelek or Chaim Simin Lamed. The Noda b'Yehuda says that you're not allowed to open an umbrella on Shabbos. And if you open an umbrella on Shabbos, potentially you're violating the Isser d'Oraisa of making an ohel on Shabbos. Mm-hmm. It's a famous Noda b'Yehuda, very famous. The Chassam Sefer in the Tshuva disagrees with the Noda b'Yehuda. The Mishnah Brura quotes this whole literature of the famous Noda b'Yehuda. So in the middle of this Noda b'Yehuda, he says, well, some argued that maybe it's not an ohel if you open an umbrella, because if you open an umbrella, then you walk with the umbrella. So that is an ohel zaruk, no? It's a moving ohel because I'm walking holding my umbrella, no? So maybe al pi halacha, it's not called an ohel if I walk with my umbrella. So the Noda b'Yehuda, in the context of this discussion, he says, well, you know, when you're walking, it could be, it's still, the halacha of ohel zaruk doesn't apply. Right? This idea that seems to be against our Tosfos, The idea that Ohel Zorok is only if it flies through the air with the greatest of ease, right? That's the only thing that's an Ohel Zorok. If it's mamish flying, this idea that's mentioned in the Mishnah Lamech that many Achrayim have, which seems to be against Taisus, the Noda Yehuda invokes this in his context of what's it called? In his context of using the umbrellas on Shabbos. Noda Yehuda discusses Artosis, but it's just an interesting application. This idea of Ohel Zorok, of course, is very famous because it comes up often in terms of Kohanim flying.
Right.
Right. A few years ago, they found out that right next to that, many of the flights that leave Israel fly over a cemetery in Chulon. So can a Kohen be on the plane?
That's what would be the thing that also...
Let me just hold the questions for a few minutes. Let me just try to finish the thought, because or else we won't complete it. I'm happy if you email me the questions after. Let me just try to finish the thought. So they found that the plane flies over the cemetery. It happens that it's not true only by Chulon. The Israeli government arranged it that the planes don't fly over the cemetery in Chulon anymore. But right next to Kennedy Airport, there's Woodlawn Cemetery, no?
Mm-hmm.
And so how does a Kohen fly? May fly over a cemetery. So it's not a simple question.
Well, they changed
it. Again, let's just try to finish the thought. Not a simple question. Another issue that is slightly more problematic is very often today, corpses, niftarim, are brought to Israel for burial. You go on a plane, you're a Kohen, you go on a plane. It could be there's a dead body in the plane with you, in the cargo area. In the plane, it could be there's a dead body. It's likely there's a dead body. So what do we do? So the sugya of Ohel Zorok is really very relevant. But Ohel Zorok, interestingly, goes in opposite directions. If Ohel Zorok lo shmei Ohel, and that's how we paskin, the Rambam paskins that way, that a flying tent is not a tent, a flying Ohel is not an Ohel. So that would mean that if I fly over the cemetery, I am in an airplane. The airplane is an Ohel, right? It's a self-contained, like, thing. But Ohel Zarek Lo Shmei Ohel. So therefore, it doesn't protect me. The Tumah, right, goes right through the airplane. It makes me Tumah. And the Kayin is going to become Tumah. That would be a problem. Again, there might be ways of getting around this. But Ohel Zarek might mean that since it's not a good Ohel, you can't fly over the cemetery. But Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Etshuva and Siman Ayin Beis says, well, if I take this Ohel Zorok idea, I could also have a very big kula. Meaning, if I have a corpse in the cargo hold of the airplane, so Ohel Zorok lo shmei Ohel, no? I'm not in the same Ohel. Because the thing that I'm in is a flying thing, no? So while I'm flying, it's not an Ohel. So yeah, there's a dead body in the plane with me, but it's halachically, we're not in an Ohel, because the thing that I'm in is not an Ohel halachically, because it's flying, it's Ohel Zorok. Of course, you have to recognize that before you take off and after you land, you're in the... you're in the plane. You, the Kohen, are in the plane with a corpse. It is not so simple. It happens that Al Pi Halacha, there are ways of packaging, pardon the expression, I have no other way of saying it, of packaging the mace so that the Tumah will not go throughout the entire cabin. I don't know how many of you remember these. A couple of years ago, there was like on Facebook and Twitter. There are pictures going around of like a Kohen sitting like inside a plastic thing on the plane in order to protect him from Tumah. You really don't have to do that because most, at least when you have a mace in the cargo hold, the mace generally are packed in a way. There is a fellow, Pinchas Manda, I think he passed away, now his son runs the business, who used to like package all the mason to go to Eretz Yisrael. It was better actually to fly El Al because Pinchas Mandel would package all the mason that went on El Al. If you would fly Swiss Air or some other Royal Jordanian or whatever you're going to fly, so it could be there's a mace there that's not packaged well. It's also potentially more of a problem to fly from Florida to New York. No, it's not so uncommon. Again, my understanding is that 75% of the state of Florida is not as young as I am. I'll say it like that.
Yeah, they have the highest population of seniors.
Okay, so you have a high population of seniors. People pass away in Florida, and they are flown to New York for Kavura. They don't necessarily package the mace properly. Reb Shlomo Zalman entertains the idea that maybe Ohel Zarek Lo Shmei Ohel means that at least while you're flying, you're not tummy. Yeah, okay, great. But before you take off and after you land, it still is going to be a problem. And also Reb Shlomo Zalman says it's a little bit absurd to assume that I'm in the same area as the tumah. Right? I'm here, dead guy here. I'm right next to the dead guy. But because we're flying, I'm not tummy because I was actually, it's a little bit strange, right? So that whole tshuva in the Mincha Shlomo is there to address these questions. Reb Shlomo Zalman gave rules about how to package the mesim, etc. So these halachas of Ohel Zarek that Tosis mentions in our context is actually very relevant for flying over cemeteries and the like. Again, as a matter of halacha, there are kulas around it. We assume that flying over a cemetery, even though the kohen might become tamei, but the halacha of tumas kohanim, the prohibition of a kohen, is not that the kohen can't become tamei, but that the kohen can't be in the proximity of a mace. If you're flying 15, 20,000 feet over the mace, so then even though Tumah goes all the way up, but it could be you're not, as a Kohen, you're not in violation of the prohibition of making yourself Tumah, because the prohibition, Rav Shachter explains, is not to make yourself Tumah. The prohibition is to be close by, near a mace. That's one explanation. There's a number of other explanations. I have a number of shiurim that I give on this topic. About how we solve the problem of Kohanim flying, but our Tosis is just an introduction to that. And Yitzhak Hashem, next week, we'll come back to this Gemara and we'll connect it to our Mishnah. But basically, we got into a conversation that Rabbi Yehuda says to be an Ohel, it has to be man-made. We have a question, but in the Para Aduma context, they have oxen that count as an Ohel. How does that work? So the Gemara answered, well, if it's very wide, Rabbi Yehuda says, even if it's not man-made, it counts as an ohel. So again, these are the conversations. Thank you for coming to learn, Chavra. And everyone should have a wonderful night. Maybe those who have questions, if you could email.
No, it's not a question. It's just a comment. They changed the flight path.
Right.
From JFK to Israel.
That's they keep on changing it because the people, my parents are somewhat close to JFK. They don't want everyone to lose a night's sleep when all the planes fly over. So they constantly are adjusting the flight path, but sometimes you're going to be flying over the cemetery. Okay. Shevra, it's a pleasure as always to learn with you, and have a good night. Kotov, all the best.
You too.
Good night.